You are listening to episode number 241 of the Reversing Diabetes with Delaine MD podcast.
Welcome to Reversing Diabetes with Delaine MD, where women who are confused and worried about their type 2 diabetes come to learn strategies to fix it. I'm your host, Dr. Delaine Vaughn. Ladies, if you know you are capable of doing badass things at work and for your family, but you're frustrated with why you can't seem to stop eating the chocolate cake, this podcast is for you. Let's talk.
Hello, welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad that you're taking some time and joining me today. I'm glad you're taking some time for your health and committing to you and taking care of you. And I hope that's what this is for you today. So today we are going to talk about fasting more. That's kind of what we're going to be talking about most of this month. Last week we talked about intermittent fasting and how it impacts your insulin resistance and how fasting will allow your cells to heal and they get a break from insulin exposure, and that this allows the insulin sensitivity to return and kind of normalize your cell function so that you can get normal blood sugars and get your A1C down and, you know, knock the socks off your doctor when you go and see them, and they'll be surprised at the work you've done. Okay. That was episode number 242. We are going to talk today about regimens for intermittent fasting and kind of how to get started, the how-to of it. I will offer that a lot of women, when they hear that this is, and it is, it's such an incredibly powerful tool, and they hear that and they understand like the science behind it, like, oh, I'm giving my cells a break from the insulin exposure. And when I do that, it allows them to start behaving normally. And they're like, heck yeah, let's go. And they go from eating, maybe they're eating, you know, 16, 15 hours a day. And they're like, I'm going to cut back to eating only 8 hours a day. And they hate life. And they think I'm a royal turd. And they don't think fasting works. And they're like, this is horrible. I don't ever want to do this again. So I want to teach a different method of doing that so that this can be something sustainable for you. I do want to revisit the idea of hunger and discuss like the determination between brain hunger and physical hunger. This is such an important aspect to fasting. Okay. Clearly, to be able to do a fast and give your cells some time to not be exposed to insulin so they can heal, if we're going to do that, we clearly are going to have to tolerate or at least learn to navigate messages from the environment and messages from our body that we want to eat. Okay. I always kind of think it was evolutionarily beneficial for our brains to decide we were hungry when we saw food, right? So if you think about it, 10,000 years ago, food wasn't on every corner at every Quick Trip or gas station or convenience store for us to consume. When we came across food, whether it was like on accident or whether we were hunting and gathering, it was really important that we were driven, that we had some kind of motivation to eat that food. Okay, because you don't know when you're coming across food again. 10,000 years ago, you didn't, right? So when we see food, our brains typically will start to send some hunger signaling out, right? Like, oh, this is important. And this is part of that dopamine effect. This is important. We should definitely eat this. Okay. So when we see food, we frequently will feel the urge to eat. And that's evolutionarily probably a benefit to us. In today's age, when we're all eating ourselves into a state of disease, it's probably not so helpful. But learning how to navigate real physical hunger, like it's time for me to actually start bringing some nutrient inside of my body, that real hunger that I hate using the word real, like the other one's fake. It's not that it's fake, but there is hunger that is biologically driven and a biological necessity. And then there's hunger that is driven by our mental state and our emotional state. And there is no biological necessity for that. So learning to determine between those two things is incredibly important to learn to use fasting in an effective way, okay? Because you're going to see others eating when it's not your eating time, because we live in America and human beings in America eat all day long. That's what we do. So we're going to have to learn to kind of navigate hunger. And so I do think it's important to revisit this whole idea of brain hunger versus physical hunger. So if you think about brain hunger, right? Brain hunger is hunger that originates in our brain versus physical hunger is hunger that originates in our body. The human body has a central nervous system and a peripheral nervous system. That's what we call it in science. It's kind of one way to divide the nervous system out. The central nervous system is composed of our brain and the spinal cord. The peripheral nervous system is all of the nerves that extend to the outer parts of our body, extend away from the brain and the spinal cord into our body. And it senses stuff. That's what the peripheral nervous system does. This is where heat sensors are in your fingertips, so you can tell if something's hot. This is where there is the ability to determine sharpness. That's also in the peripheral nervous system. So if you step on a tack with your toe, you're going to sense that. Your peripheral nervous system is going to sense that, not your central nervous system. Your central nervous system is going to decipher that or decode that, but your peripheral nervous system is what is actually sensing these experiences. If you're chilly, if you're cold, if you, I'm trying to think of the other feelings, the feeling of wetness, that's all something that we are going to pick up with our peripheral nervous system. So when our sensor organs in our fingertips and our skin, and even in our visceral body, so inside our stomach, inside our abdominal cavity, there are peripheral sensors in those organs and in those parts of our bodies as well. When they pick up information, that information that happens on our fingertips, that we pick up on our fingertips, travels through nerves to the central nervous system. So it travels from the peripheral nervous system to the central nervous system. The central nervous system then brings it up to the brain, and the brain decodes it. It deciphers what's going on. It interprets what's happening. Oh, that's warm. It's getting almost too warm. I probably need to, bring my hand off to avoid any injury. Same thing with cold. That's cold, right? Like some things that are cool feel nice, but when they're cold, they actually start to hurt and we bring our hands away. This is all decoding and deciphering and interpretation that happens in the central nervous system from information that is picked up in the peripheral nervous system. Okay. So when we're looking at hunger, hunger is one of those experiences that can be describing something that's happening in our peripheral nervous system or being sensed by our peripheral nervous system and then being brought to our central nervous system where our brain decodes it. That can be what hunger is. But hunger can also be something that is assigned from our central nervous system in our brain to our body, right? So I'm hungry for love. People will say those things, right? Or there's a real hunger within that kid, meaning there's a drive, there's ambition, right? Drive and ambition does not happen in the peripheral nervous system. There's no sensory organ or sensory cell on your fingertip that touches and be like, oh, that's anticipation or that's motivation. That is drive. That's hunger, right? Like that's not how it works. That's not how what we mean by that hunger. Okay. Sometimes hunger is a thought that we have in our brain that we assign to our body. Sometimes it's like motivation and drive. But what we're of course talking about when we're talking about fasting is the hunger that starts in our brain and we assign to our stomach and make it mean. We interpret, like, we decide that, like, we're just defining this as, oh, we need to eat food, right? Versus a hunger that starts in our stomach as an emptiness. Maybe there's a growling, although you can't even rely on growling because growling will occur when you are processing your food. Like when you have a belly full of food and your stomach's churning and processing that food, that will be a growling noise that you hear. So you can't even depend on growling as a yes or no. That means I'm physically hungry. But hunger that starts in your belly is an emptiness. It's going to be associated with a time frame when you haven't eaten in quite some time. It is going to be something that comes and goes. It will ebb and flow. That's how hunger, physical hunger, is in our visceral organs, because just our visceral organs, the organs the sensory experience inside of our body cavities is different than the sensory experience that happens in our fingertips or our feet, okay, or on our skin. So you're going to have this experience with physical hunger, right? If you just ate 2 hours ago, the food that you ate 2 hours ago is still inside your stomach. So emptiness is not inside your stomach because food has taken up that emptiness. Okay. So these are kind of some things that to consider when trying to determine, am I physically hungry? Am I brain hunger, right? What is brain hunger? Brain hunger is I am overwhelmed in the middle of the afternoon and suddenly I feel like I need to eat. Like maybe food would help, right? Or I'm tired in the afternoon. And your brain will verbalize this. This is the thought that will be, oh, I need a little bit of energy. Energy happens with food. I need to eat food, right? Even though you just ate at lunch at two, you know, at lunch at noon at 2:30, suddenly you're like, ooh, I'm hungry. I think I got to eat because I need energy, right? Those are hunger. That is a hunger that starts in our brain and our brain assigns it to our body versus the kind of hungry that starts in our peripheral nervous system in our stomach and it travels up our spine, our central nervous system to our brain and your brain decodes it, deciphers it, interprets it as it's time to eat. This is that we actually need to consume some energy. Okay. So those are the differences between physical hunger and brain hunger. It gets more complicated when we have been eating processed foods. When we want to change the behavior from eating the processed foods, but we are in the we've still eaten the processed food. The way that modern processed foods impact our hormones and our neurobiology, our neurochemistry, means that when we eat those foods, we cannot be relying on the messaging and signaling from our bodies and our brains to be accurate. Those messages that tell us we're hungry, which is why I just ate Doritos. I don't know why, but here I am. I'm still hungry. The reason that that is because we cannot rely on the messages that come from our body anymore when those messages are, I don't know, under the influence of processed foods. Processed foods are meant to be hyperpalatable. What does that mean? That's a term they use in food science. That's hyperpalatable. Means that on our mouth, in our mouth, it feels good. It's like hyper feeling good. It's hyperpalatable inside our mouth. We like the way it feels. There may be a coolness, a melty feeling, a creaminess, the lightness, maybe like if you think about how powdered sugar hits your mouth, like that's a palatability. That's a hyper palatability thing. Okay. So you like the way it tastes. You like the way it tastes. It's got flavor enhancers. So taste enhancers in it. So you like the taste of it. You like the way it feels in your mouth and they design it. They engineer it. So there's never a feeling of fullness that comes with it. So you want to keep eating more. All of these things happen with processed foods. And not only is it the initial, like the hyperpalatability, the immediate, like it's in my mouth exposure or experience that you're having that makes you want to eat more of it. But in addition to that, there is brain chemistry that changes based on these foods that make you want more of it. Okay. We stop hearing messages from our body that tells us we're full when we're eating those processed foods. When we are insulin resistant, we are likely resistant to the hormone from our body that tells us that we are full, that we're satisfied. And we no longer hear that message from our body. And so we just continue to consume. So when we're eating those processed foods, it's very difficult to rely on the messaging from our body so that we know whether we're hungry or whether we're not. And this just means that setting some other boundaries that we're going to use to navigate as we learn how to fast and pull those foods from our body, right? Pull those foods from our diet. We're no longer going to be eating the processed foods and we're implementing a fasting regimen. We're going to have some other boundaries to navigate that, okay? Part of this is that timing component with fasting, which we're going to talk about. And then the other part that we talk about a lot, I just did a webinar earlier this week. Go to my YouTube channel, Delaine MD on YouTube, and you can find that webinar. But I did talk quite a bit about meditation as a tool to get out of your brain and into your physical body to see, are you physically truly hungry, or are you having a lot of brain chatter that's driving you to food? So I always think meditation is a great thing to talk about. It's kind of one of those things that's like, oh, you know, it's always on the table. Like, oh, I'm not sure. Maybe we should try meditation. I kind of think very, very rarely does meditation lead you to a bad place. It may not be the most effective place every time, but certainly when you're trying to figure out whether you're brain hungry or body hungry, meditation is one of the most powerful tools you can use. So we're going to talk about boundaries and that timing today as we talk about fasting regimens. So where do we start? I always encourage women to kind of start where they already are. What are you already doing for a fasting regimen? And a lot of times when women start with me, they're like, but I'm not fasting. I don't know what you mean. So unless you've mastered the art of eating food all night long when you're asleep, you are totally fasting. Everybody fasts at night unless they're eating all night long. Like, and there are people on feeding tubes that do eat at night, and that's probably got some probably not great outcomes, you know, as far as circadian rhythm. There can probably be some abnormalities that are associated with that. But for most human beings, if you are not on a feeding tube and not doing feeding tubes or feedings at night, you're already doing a fast. That's why we call it breakfast. You are breaking your fast with that first meal in the morning. So start there with what you're already doing. So if you go to bed at 11 o'clock at night, and you get up at 7 in the morning, and you get ready, maybe you go to the gym, maybe you get a shower, and maybe you're out of the house at 8:30 and grabbing something to eat at 8:30 or 9. You are already, unless you ate right until the moment you went to bed, you're probably fasting from 10 p.m. till about 8 a.m. So you've already got a 10-hour fast there. I recommend you start there. And then what you do is you just add an hour on either side. So you stop eating an hour earlier. So if you were not, you know, if you were stopping your eating time at 10 p.m., stop it at 9 p.m. And if you were starting to eat at 8 a.m., start eating at 9 a.m. and push that out by an hour on each side for 3 to 4 days and see how you feel. And then when you're ready and you feel like, okay, this isn't horrible, I've gotten to a point where this is okay, this is comfortable enough, then you add another hour. So instead of stopping at 9 p.m., you stop at 8 p.m. And instead of starting eating at 9 a.m., you start eating at 10 a.m. And you just incrementally, every 4 or so days, you stretch that fasting window farther. And what we call it is you're closing the eating window. Okay. So if you are now eating between 10 a.m. and 9 p.m., suddenly you're now eating in this 11-hour eating window, which gives you what, it gives you a 13-hour fasting window. What you want to do is extend that fasting window as much as you can. And why you want to do that is the longer that you fast, the more time your cells have to heal up from insulin resistance. I always use the analogy of having a housekeeper at your house, right? Is just fasting for the 8 hours you're asleep good enough? I mean, like, yeah, it's okay. Having the housekeeper at your house for just 4 hours is better than nothing. But having your housekeeper at the house for 8 hours is certainly better, right? She's going to get more, he's going to get more done, right? Same thing for you. If you're only fasting 8 hours while you're asleep, is it good? Well, I mean, it's probably better than nothing. It's better than eating all night long, right? But you're going to get better effects on your insulin resistance if you are fasting longer than that. So if you can extend that out to 12 or 16 hours, like suddenly you get twice as much improvement on your cellular function that way. So how long do you need to go? Like, how far do you need to extend your fast out? How much do you need to close that eating window? So first, I want you to remember that it's going to take about 7 days for you to see any changes in your blood sugars. So if you, say you were fasting again, say you were fasting for 10 hours. So from 10 p.m. to 8 a.m., that was your fasting window, kind of where you just were naturally. And you extend that out to a 9 p.m. to 9 a.m. fast. So now you're on a 12-hour fast. And you do it for 3 days, 4 days, and you're like, oh, do I need to extend it out farther? You probably will at 12 hours, but understand that you're not going to see the impact of what a 12-hour fast does until you've been doing it for 7 days. So that may be what needs to guide how quickly you change that fasting regimen, how quickly you stretch that fasting time out. Okay. So I recommend, because what I know from working with women is most women have to get close to a 16-hour fast each day with an 8-hour eating window before they start to see the results that they want. Before they start to see the lower blood sugars that they're looking for, they usually have to get to that point. So what I always tell folks is you can probably stretch, those first until you're getting to like 14-hour fast. Like at that point, you can probably start stretching it every week instead of doing it every 3 to 4 days. I recommend doing that change in your fasting regimen every 3 to 4 days initially because it can be uncomfortable, okay? And if it's miserable, you're never going to stick to it. So again, that fasting window, you want to stretch it. If, whatever you're starting at, maybe you're fasting for 8 or 9 hours a day, just naturally with your sleeping hours. And then you're going to stretch an hour on each side, right? So you're going to stop eating an hour earlier and you're going to start eating an hour later. So where it was 9 hours, now it's 11 hours. Okay. And then you're going to do that for 3 or 4 days until it gets comfortable. And then maybe you're going to stretch it even farther. You're going to stop eating at 8 p.m. and you're going to start eating maybe at 10 a.m. And that's going to give you, doing math, that's going to give you a 14-hour eating window at that point. Or I'm sorry, a 14-hour fasting window at that point. And you're just going to keep stretching that out farther and farther until you start to see your fasting blood sugar in the range that you want it. This is also true for weight loss. Until you see yourself at a rate of weight loss that you like, you're just going to start fasting a little longer every 3 to 4 days, or maybe every week. Okay. There's no shame in changing this regimen every week. And it may take you a week before you feel comfortable with it. I would definitely encourage you again that if you are eating processed foods, the more you cut those processed foods out of your life, the easier it will be for you to not feel hungry all of the time. So, some women will do, again, frequently what most women have to do is like a 16-hour fast and an 8-hour eating window. So that means that they start eating at noon and they stop eating at 8 p.m. Okay. Or they start eating at 10 and they stop eating at 6 p.m. Some women have to extend it out farther. They have to do an 18-hour fast with a 6-hour eating window. So that may be you start eating at noon and you're done by 6 p.m. And then sometimes people will extend it out farther. They'll do a 20-hour fast with a 4-hour eating window. So they maybe start at 2 o'clock in the afternoon eating and they're done by 6 p.m. Remember, again, for every hour that you're not eating, you're allowing your cells a bit longer to heal up, all right? There were years that I did actually like a 22-hour fast with a 2-hour eating window every day, and it wasn't for any crazy reasons other than it was convenient. Once you remove all of that processed foods from all, as much of that processed food as you want to remove from your life, and you start to realize that this is what's causing me to want more of it, it becomes easier to fast. I always say, people get really excited about this fasting thing. I always call it the other F word because people act like I'm talking about something horrifying or like disemboweling or something just really crazy and torturing. And recognize, as human beings on this planet, we populated the earth and became the dominant species on this planet utilizing a fasting regimen. There was not food available to pre-modern humans all the time. Period, end of sentence. It just wasn't available. Human beings fasted. Our bodies are meant to fast. This is exactly how we're designed. And when we're not following that, we get sick. So I do think there's a part of this that just matches our biology. For every, hour you're not eating, your cells are getting cleaner. Your cells are getting healthier, cleaner by the housekeeper analogy. So some, again, I used to do this longer fast. It was not painful. It was not torturing myself. It wasn't any of that. It was really convenient. I was working outside of the house for most of the, it was when I was still working like 40 hours a week outside of my business. And it was just easier to not have to tinker with making all of these meals over and over and over again. It was like one meal a day, one and done. Here we are. So, mess around with your regimen and see what works for you. I would highly, again, recommend that you start where you're at and add an hour of fasting to each side of that fasting window every 4 days until you get to the results that you want. If you have any questions about that, make sure you reach out to me. So I do encourage you to allow your blood sugars to guide, or your weight loss, again, to guide when you need to make adjustments. Okay, so you may do, say you do a 19-hour fast with a 5-hour eating window. Say that's what you just settle out at, and you do that for like 3 months, and you like your results, and you like that you're getting your blood sugars down, but your weight stalls out. You may have to make some adjustments, okay? Like that may be a place where you're like, okay, I'm going to do a 4-hour eating window and a, 20-hour fasting window. It would probably be that you were doing an 8-hour fasting or an 8-hour eating window and a 16-hour fasting window. You may have to narrow that. I imagine that you would get weight loss at that, 19-5 window pretty easily for most women. But you may have to adjust after something that you've been doing for a very long time. It may have worked for a long time, and then at some point, maybe your results start too slow, and you have to maybe make some adjustments at that point. Again, give yourself a chance. Please do not do it any quicker than every 3 to 4 days, because most women find that either they're like coercing themselves to do the thing, like it's really hard and they're just forcing themselves to do it, or they find that they're not, giving themselves the opportunity to get comfortable with the, hard stuff of the fasting before they change something and do something new. Okay. If you are using fasting, and I'll talk about this at the end of the podcast, but be careful if you're medicated. If you are taking insulin injections, you really like mealtime insulin injections need to be associated with a meal. And if you're not eating, you're going to have to make some adjustments to those. So make sure you contact your primary care, whoever's giving you those prescriptions, and let them know that you're going to implement this and see how they want you to adjust your insulin injections or your meds in general. So another question that I get from women is, am I going to have to do this forever? My experience and my experience with the clients that I work with is not likely. This is a tool that I have taught you. I've taught you how to use a hammer. I've taught you how to use a screwdriver. I've taught you how to use a drill, right? Like, fasting is the hammer. It's the screwdriver. It's the drill. It's a tool that you are learning how to use. You will unlikely be able to go back to eating all day, right? Like, you're not going to be able to go back to the standard American diet where we humans eat all day long, but it's unlikely you're going to have to do whatever fasting regimen has gotten you to the results that you are at for the rest of your life. Again, there was years that I did either a 20 or a 22 hour fast every day with a 2 or a 4 hour eating window. And it wasn't because I was trying to, weigh 12 pounds or anything crazy. It was just convenient. Okay. When my schedule changed, I was able to liberate that eating window quite a bit. I would say now that my eating window is usually 6 to 8 hours and I fast for the rest of the time. Once you cut the processed foods from your brain, it becomes very easy, like just real straightforward to eat that way. There's not a lot of difficulty associated with that. But it's unlikely that you are going to have to continue to eat with that maybe more aggressive fasting regimen for the rest of your life. You'll likely get some increased flexibility that you'll be able to have once your cells have healed, but you do have to get your cells to that healed state. I do want to remind, I talked about this a little bit last week, and I do want to say it again because I think it's important. Be careful of using fasting to undo your out of control behaviors with your food. Lots of times women will do this. They'll go to a get together, they'll go to a party, and they'll sit there and they'll be looking at the brownies and they'll be like, I know I didn't plan for it, but my God, they look so good and they're my favorite and I bet they taste so good. And there's only one left and I really should probably eat it because what if there's nothing? I'm going to miss it. And they talk themselves into eating these foods. And of course, the one brownie leads to some chips because after you have the sweet stuff, you have to have the salty stuff, you know? And then after you have the salty stuff, you're like, ooh, I need a little sweetness to even that out. And before you know it, you're hitting the candy jar. And then you're going to end up with the, you know, peanuts or the nut bowl after that. It's just this cycle that we get into. And it's making concessions that in the end, we're not really willing to pay the price for is what it comes down to. At the end of it, we feel guilty. We feel disappointed in ourselves and are like, how do I undo what I just did? I just messed up big time. What do I do? And women turn to really bizarre and aggressive fasting regimens in these moments. They're like, oh, I ate all those things so badly. I think I'm going to fast all day tomorrow to make up for it. So the reason that I say be careful of this is not because it doesn't work per se. Okay. In fact, I recommend this this using fasting as this tool in this way, like whenever we go on vacation or whenever it's the holidays or whenever there's an event that you're going to go to and you want to indulge in foods that are not typical of what you eat. So whenever I go on vacation, I usually fast when I travel. There's nothing at a gas station. There's nothing in an airport that I can't live without and that I want to eat. And it's expensive. And so I just fast. And I also know that wherever I'm traveling to, I'm likely going to have a meal there that is going to be spectacular and likely not typical of what I usually eat. So I use fasting as a tool preemptively in order to manage or mitigate the negative effect that those foods that I don't typically eat will have on my body. Okay. That is one thing, to do it in a planned way, a controlled way, where you're like, okay, I'm going to fast and the fast is going to kind of blow and I'm going to enjoy this meal and I'm planning on it. There's not this excitement that kind of leads you to this out of control phase, this chaos that happens in your brain. None of that's going on. I think using fasting in that way as a tool to minimize the negative impact of some of these highly processed foods that you may indulge in certain situations, I think that's brilliant. I really do. Again, on Christmas, I think it's the same thing. On Thanksgiving, same thing. If you want to fast for a long fast before, or if you're like Friday after Thanksgiving, I'm going to do a long fast because I'm knowing I'm overindulging on Thanksgiving Day, I think that's great. I think that when it becomes a problem is when we, again, are making concessions in a moment based on instant gratification and not long-term benefits to our body. We're making concessions in the moment that we don't agree to. And that really breaks down a relationship with ourselves where we can trust ourselves to do the things that we plan to do, even when it's not fun, even when it's a little hard. Okay. So when we're using fasting to undo or erase the things that we ate or something that we did, I don't think that's horribly effective. And I think it actually works against us. So I want to warn you, and I call them like bizarre fasting behaviors. If it's starting to feel like this, this maybe unhealthy relationship, you're going to have to really get clear about what's going on. Are you making these fasting decisions ahead of time? Or are you making these fasting decisions in response to something that you did that you're trying to minimize the negative impact? Okay. And if you're doing that kind of in a retrospective way, you may be working against yourself there. So be aware of that. Lastly, I want to talk about meds. This, I've used to give this warning in the beginning, and I've kind of moved this warning to the end because people who've listened to the podcast for a long time, they know this warning. If you're new to the podcast, I do want you to hear this because I do think it's important. If you have been medicated for the way you, or for your type 2 diabetes, you have been medicated because of the way you have eaten in the past. If you change the way you eat, if you add a fasting regimen, if you cut processed foods from your life, if you change the way that you're eating in those ways, you're going to likely need to change your medication regimen as well. That means you need to get on the phone with your provider who has given you these meds, and you need to tell them what you're doing. And you need to tell them, I need to know how you want me to share my blood sugar logs with you, and I need to know from you how I can expect to hear what medication changes you want me to make so that you can stay safe. That's what's really important here. If you don't get this guidance on how to change your medications, you can get very, very sick, the kind of sick that involves going to the hospital, maybe getting a hospital stay, maybe possibly even death. And that's not what we're doing this work for. We are doing this work to live long, healthy lives, and that is going to work against you. So make sure you've contacted your primary care or your specialist or whoever has prescribed these medications to you. Let them know what you're intending to do. Ask them how they want you to share your information, i.e. your blood sugar log with them, and how they intend to share feedback about what you need to do differently with your meds, how they're going to share that information with you. Get real clear on that so you can stay safe. If you haven't already and you're looking to see better blood sugars, please go to delanemd.com/better, B-E-T-T-E-R, B-E-T-T-E-R, sorry. DelaneMD/better. You can find my 14 days to better blood sugar guide there. This is a guide that will give you 14 days of breakfast, lunch, and dinner menus, and they will definitely improve your blood sugars. Again, if you're medicated, be very careful as you use this because it will bring your blood sugars down and it will do it pretty quickly. So I'll also get you on my email list so you can get updates on other help that I have available for you. Don't forget, you can always find me on Instagram and Facebook at DelaneMD. If you ever have any questions, you can always email me at Delane@DelaneMD.com. I'm happy to answer any questions. If there's anything you want to hear about in a podcast, put it in there. I can definitely research it and get some information out in the podcast for you. If you're interested in finding out more about my group where I work with women to help them reverse their type 2 diabetes, you can find out information on my website or you can email me and we can set up some time to chat about that. Lastly, I have an ask. If you like this podcast, if you're getting benefits from this podcast, if you're getting help from this podcast, I wonder if you would rate and review the podcast on your podcast player. The more ratings and reviews this podcast get, the more it will be presented to other people so that they can hear this information and they can get the same help you're getting. You can rate it on your podcast player. You can share it on social media. You can email it to a friend, however it works for you. Remember, 9 out of 10 of Americans have insulin resistance. They are on the path to type 2 diabetes. Everybody needs to hear that they do not need to live the rest of their life sick. Help me get the word out. The more you rate and review it, the more you share this, the more it helps get that word out. People need to hear about this. I want you to keep listening. I want you to keep avoiding foods that are making you sick. Keep making choices in the favor, in the direction of your health and your vitality and longevity. I'll be back next week. Bye-bye.